You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
You'll probably recognize Rob Gifford's voice. That's because he was NPR's Beijing correspondent for 6 years, and then he began the journey on which he's based China Road, his first book. Mr. Gifford started out in Shanghai and traveled 3,000 miles west on Route 312 to China's border with Kazakhstan. Along the way, he met peasants, teachers, businessmen, monks, prostitutes, and others who helped him understand how the lives of ordinary citizens are being transformed by China's rapid industrialization. His book is published by Random House, and I'm very pleased it has brought Rob Gifford to my show today. Hello.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
China has recently overtaken Britain as the world's fourth largest economy. You became the London bureau chief. Are you moving? Is this a downwardly mobile job?
Moving backwards in time. Yeah, it feels that a little bit, because certainly in terms of the time frame, when you look at the stage that China's at, in many ways, it's really in the 19th century. If you're talking industrially, it's going through the Industrial Revolution.
And in Britain, people left the farms and moved to the cities to work in the factories. The same thing is happening in China, only on a much larger scale.
Absolutely. And I mean, in the 19th century, what was the population of Great Britain? About 12 million. I mean, that's the population of Shanghai, one Chinese city. And I think there's a lot of the same kind of emotional, psychological, physical dislocation and upheaval going on, not to mention the economic changes.
Any estimates as to how many people have been thought to have moved to the cities?
Well, they say between 150 and 200 million people Wow. have left the countryside.
And most of those are in the class that used to be called peasants, at least in Mao's time.
That's right.
Call them old 100 names.
The old 100 names is the name that the Chinese language uses for ordinary people. They're called Lao Bai Xing. And in Chinese tradition, in Chinese legend, the word just 100 family names. And so, and there still are not very many family names. There are 90 million people whose last name is Li, and nearly 90 million people whose last name is Wang. But they're known as the Lao Bai Xing. We, and Chinese people talk about it, we the old 100 names. And that is actually ordinary people in the countryside and in the cities.
Is relocating the only way that these rural Chinese can get ahead?
In many cases, yes, it is. I mean, you're up to your knees in a paddy field somewhere growing rice, and you're earning nothing. It's subsistence farming. And so what has happened now is that the factories have been built, especially along the coast, and really the only way to improve your life is to get on a bus and go there.
But is working in a factory any major improvement?
Well, it is, definitely. And this is the great sort of contradiction at the heart of so much of economic development in China. I mean, we quite rightly talk about labor rights issues. I've reported very broadly on labor rights issues in the factories of China. Some of the factories are terrible. They are Dickensian. Again, the 19th century comparison. But if you talk to a lot of the people who work there, they are not saying that it's particularly good in terms of conditions, but they are earning more in 1 month in a factory in Shanghai or Guangdong province on the coast than they would earn in a year farming. So a lot of people are willing to put up with the worse conditions because it's simply allowing them to earn more money.
But there are, you mentioned contradictions. One of the contradictions is that China officially continues to be a communist state, although ordinary Chinese people can no longer count on the benefits the communist system used to provide. And that includes paying for health care, for schools for their children, used to be provided free by the government. So what has happened here? Have they completely ignored Marx's old line about workers of the world unite?
They have. They've just moved away from it, basically. I mean, of course, Chairman Mao developed his own form of Marxism. He took the revolution to the peasants. There was no urban proletariat in the 1930s really to draw on. So he adapted Marxism for China, where it's the farmers in the countryside who are the most numerous. And then he set about building his own kind of Maoism. But after he died, it was clear that 30 years of Maoism had really led China down a dead end. And Deng Xiaoping, his successor, opened it up, and what you have now really is a return to the market economy. And so you still have a one-party state. Politically, that's very important to say. Politically, it is still a Leninist state, but economically and socially, it has been transformed out of all recognition.
And unemployment has become a huge problem that didn't exist under the old communist system.
Absolutely. Because, of course, one of the things that Mao did was he gave a job to everyone, and it was all very much from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs. And so they had these, when they emerged into these market reforms, you have these massive kind of steel mills that provide cradle to grave employment and healthcare and, you know, a pension and everything and schools, but they were completely top-heavy, overloaded with people, far too many employees. So what's happened now is the market reforms have cut the people, number of people employed there, and those people are out and unemployed, something that was unthinkable 20 years ago.
How do they survive?
Well, they often get a very small pension from the state that allows them just a mere sort of subsistence. But this is a very, very big problem now, because you're starting to get angry people in the cities who feel that they have not been looked after by the state, and they feel that they are not taking part in this great social economic revolution that is happening around them.
Well, there have been little uprisings all throughout China, haven't there?
Absolutely.
This is a country that is able to quell them so far. But you wonder what would happen if, as has happened in the past, people started connecting the dots and a larger uprising resulted.
Absolutely. And that's really the big question. And it's one of the things I really go into in the book, is that we look from outside and we see China rising. It looks really quite strong from the outside. And it looks economically as though it is going to be the big economic superpower. It is already in so many ways. But the reason that I took the journey westwards from Shanghai is really because I think a journey west is a journey into China's frailties. And I think there are a lot of fault lines now appearing. In 2005, there were 80,000 incidents of rural unrest in China. And that's a lot of problems going on. And the government is really having to deal with this and try to stop it from joining together and creating some organized rebellion.
My guest is Rob Gifford of NPR, formerly the Beijing Bureau Chief, now the London Bureau Chief. He's written a book called China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power. You've written that in the United States you need money to get power, but in China you need power to get money. You're talking about political power?
Yes, political power. And this is one of the biggest problems in China, is that it is still a one-party state. So what does that mean? The money comes pouring in from foreign investors. How do they set up their factory? How do they get their distribution network up? They have to go through the local Communist Party officials. So, of course, the Communist Party officials take a cut, line their own pockets, and they are now in a position where the Communist Party officials are the most corrupt people in the country.
The other day, we spoke to someone who'd written a book about the most wanted man in China, somebody who started off trying to play by the rules and found out that he was being forced to hand out so many bribes. He decided to play the game as it was played, became a billionaire, but then a warrant was issued for his arrest, and he now lives in Vancouver. Four of his associates have been executed. So you can play this game, but if it starts embarrassing people near the top, you can pay a price as well?
That's right. But, of course, you need to have protectors quite high up. And the problem is, this is the biggest problem of the one-party state, is that, you know, you can't really do anything to stop it, because you can't implement proper checks and balances, because then that would limit your power.
And the corruption and the taxes and the need to pay bribes has led to these 200 incidents of rural unrest that China has pretty much every day.
That's right. And I think again, down at the bottom level, this is part of the decentralization of China as well. In the communist days, the height of communism, Beijing subsidized everything. Now what they've done is they've cut the provinces loose, and so the local officials, They have to raise money somehow in order to pay for healthcare, pay for education, and they're doing that through all sorts of scams and through the time-honored way of gouging the peasants.
So is China more like a continent than a country with these different areas, the equivalent of separate states?
In some ways, it is. And this, I mean, the example I use in the book actually is Roman Europe. I mean, in many ways, it is more like Roman Europe than it is. We often think of China in comparison to the United States because of the sheer geographical size of it. But actually, it is lots of small little statelets. I mean, you can't call, back 2,000 years ago, they were separate little states. But nowadays, they're all joined together. The fear is, of course, if something were to happen, and this has happened throughout Chinese history, if something happened to cause the center to collapse, they do then all become separate little fiefdoms again.
And they all have separate languages, although Mandarin does the country together today. And you speak Mandarin. Were you able to get through no matter where because you're fluent in Mandarin?
Pretty much. I mean, that's one of the good things that the Communist Party has done is to standardize Mandarin. In the past, people from different parts of the country could often only have conversations on paper. So they would have what was known as a written conversation because their local dialects were so different. Now, pretty much everywhere they speak Mandarin, often with a heavy accent.
A truck driver you met, Lin Zhang, I guess is how you pronounce it, describe the current atmosphere in China as man-eat-man. That means it's worse than dog-eat-dog?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that gives you, it's a very sort of evocative phrase, and it is. It's the Wild West in many ways.
Well, how much worse can it be than the Cultural Revolution of 25 to 30 years ago?
I think it's worse in a different way. First of all, I don't want to say worse as though everything's bad. 300 million people have entered the new middle class in the last 15 years. So there's clearly a lot of good improvement going on. But in terms of the things that have got worse, I think it's to do with the corruption and the economic corruption. And so in the Cultural Revolution in the 60s, that was very politically based, and it was all attack the West, the people who were seen to be bourgeois. And now, you know, being bourgeois is an aspiration and not a crime. And so the problems are coming from the economic side and not from the political side.
But there's a serious income gap between rich and poor, and yet you say you saw signs posted by the government encouraging Chinese citizens to strive for moderate prosperity.
Right.
Does it seem ironic to anyone but you that a communist government would officially encourage capitalist activities and then talk about moderate prosperity as though you could only go so far, and then you say, I'm comfortable.
I mean, I don't think they're putting a limit on the prosperity. I think if people can get richer than moderate prosperity, that's fine. But the irony of it is much more clear to Westerners, I think, because Chinese people are not actually too bothered by labels. They're not too, you know, they officially call it what's going on at the moment, socialism with Chinese characteristics. Now, nobody really cares. To us, it's like, well, that's so hypocritical. That's so, you know, that's so unbalanced. That's so weird that you would put those two things together. But for Chinese people, it's kind of, if it works, then, you know, that's fine. So call it whatever you want, when in fact it's pure industrial capitalism.
Is there still a state-run industry?
There is, sure. And it's a lot of those industries are not doing particularly well. A lot of them are being reformed. As I mentioned, they're being cut back. The workforce is being cut down, and they're being streamlined. So it does still exist, and it's not strictly speaking possible. You can't say China is completely capitalist, because it's not. Some people call it, what's the phrase? Leninist corporatism, which means that there is still a lot of direction coming from the state into the state-owned industries. But there's no doubt that it's the market-run industries that are really, having the upper hand now and starting to really drive the economy.
I'm talking with Rob Gifford about his book, China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power, published by Random House. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Rob Gifford, who went to China first in 1987 as a 20-year-old language student. He spent much of the last 20 years studying and reporting there, and from 1999 to 2005, he was the Beijing correspondent for National Public Radio, traveled all over China, and sent back reports, which are the basis for his new book called China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power, published by Random House. Nowadays, he is NPR's London bureau chief. So how long did it take you to make this 3,000-mile journey?
It was 2 months, actually. It was just before I left China, and I took 2 months to do the whole trip. The distance is, it's a bit like traveling across the U.S. It's a similar sort of distance. And in a way, I've written the book in a kind of Route 66 kind of way. You know, get your kicks on Route 312. And in some ways, you know, there are some comparisons, although I think the comparison is less of a sort of less of a Jack Kerouac kind of 1950s or 60s comparison and more of a John Steinbeck Grapes of Wrath kind of approach, because the people are really fleeing the countryside, as you suggested, and coming to the cities along Route 312.
Well, and also Kerouac went in a car. You used public transportation and cabs when you had to. In his Los Angeles Times review of your book, Carl Taro Greenfeld objected to your having quoted Chinese cab drivers. He said that when he was the editor of Time Magazine's Asia edition, he instituted a no quotes from taxi drivers policy.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. I mean, you're there. There's the guy. He speaks Chinese. He's living the life. You know,
but cab drivers perhaps have a specific kind of take on things.
I think so. I mean, I don't use them indiscriminately, but occasionally, if you're sitting there talking to a guy for hours on end, they often have interesting things to say.
And you had a funny experience on a long drive with one cabbie and his, quotes, wife.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he was. He asked if his wife could come along, and then it soon became apparent that she was his mistress, and they were off on a little weekend jaunt at my expense. You know, again, that kind of stuff happens, and that's in a way that was what the book was about. I mean, jump in a taxi, find out who the guy is, and then you get to meet his mistress as well. Jump on a bus, you know, who you're going to sit next to, who's it going to be, stick out your thumb beside the road, who's the truck driver who picks you up. Stuff just kind of falls in your lap.
Although that can also be dangerous. Mr. Greenfeld wrote that many journalists aspire to taking long road trips through China, but few do because of the difficulty and the possible dangers.
Yes, I think the dangers are more the danger that you're going to get involved in some kind of pile-up because the driving's not so good.
And not getting arrested?
In terms of getting arrested, we got stopped for speeding once, but that's the thing about modern China, is that you can fly beneath the radar quite a lot. You know, I think in the book I use the comparison, you know, it used to be like a birdcage. Everyone in China, including the foreigners, lived in a birdcage. They controlled what you did and where you went and what you thought.
And you were easily spotted, too.
Of course. And now it's become like an aviary. You know, there is this room to fly around. You can't fly up into the clear blue sky, and they can still catch you if they want to. It's not sort of freedom as it is in the West completely. But they've given people, including the foreigners who live there, a sort of space to live.
You started in Shanghai, which you've compared to Manhattan in 1910.
Yes, I think there are some comparisons there. I think partly, you know, the migration thing. I mean, the immigrants came from across the water, mainly from Europe into Manhattan. In China, they're coming from inland. But there's a very similar sort of feeling of a city as well, not just because of the migrants, but just a city on the verge of greatness.
Well, wasn't it that before the Communist Revolution, it was the most Europeanized city, and then during all the years, the Mao years, it just got left, and buildings weren't knocked down, new buildings weren't built, and so in an odd way, it looks like Manhattan in the 1930s and 40s.
Right, but I think the difference now is that there is a whole new world in China. In the 1930s, China was in chaos. It was really, Shanghai was a great sort of playground for the foreigners, but it wasn't really a place of hope for the Chinese so much. It was a little bit. Now you've got this great industrial giant rising, and there is a reason for people to go there and to take Route 312 and to come there like they came to Manhattan with these hopes of starting a new life.
Does it have that same kind of energy?
Absolutely. I mean, and you know those pictures from the 20s and 30s of like the workmen in Manhattan sitting on the girders up as the Empire State Building was being built, you know, the safety standards in terms of construction and all of these things. The feel is very, I mean, obviously I wasn't there 100 years ago in Manhattan, but you get the feel of it. And as I finished the journey, actually, I flew back to Shanghai from the Kazakh border. And I remember just standing, looking out over the Huangpu River from this wonderful old building and seeing just the craziness of modern China. And I wrote the words in my notebook. I just wrote, Shanghai is America. And it feels like that, the hope that is there, of course, alongside many problems, just as, you know, turn of the 20th century America had many problems.
Well, now that you're back in England, haven't you noticed that people generally speak more softly than people did in places like Shanghai?
That is true. I've never actually asked anyone this, but apparently there's no word for whisper in the Chinese language. I need to find out if that's true. It's one of those urban myths.
Why were people speaking so loudly?
I think that's just the sort of just the way it happens there. I think it's the kind of opposite of being English, you know, where everyone has to talk in these sort of hushed whispers, and God forbid that anyone would hear your accent and find out what class you are. You know, in Shanghai, it's all part of, you know, just getting into the 21st century, and everything's out in the open. People are very upfront. They sort of, you sit next to them on the bus and they say, so how much money do you earn? And, you know, they're very...
Would you give them an honest answer?
I tend to sort of ask them to guess, you know, so that... Because often these are people who are earning like $100 a month. And, you know, even on an NPR salary, I do earn more than that.
Rob Gifford of NPR has written a book called China Road, A Journey into the Future of a Rising Power, published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Was part of the attraction of undertaking this trip the huge variety of ethnic groups and cultures that you knew in advance that you would encounter in traveling down this one road?
Very, very much so. I mean,
people look different in different parts.
Very, very different. I mean, half of the geographical area of China is inhabited by people who are not ethnically Chinese. I'm talking about the Tibetans, obviously, and the Uyghur Muslims, who are a Turkic group related to the people of Central Asia and to the Turks. And so that is a very important part of modern China, because those people, many of them, don't want to be a part of China.
Well, when you go to a place like Shanghai, which has become a magnet city, or Hefei, 250 miles west of Shanghai, which is kind of like the Silicon Valley of China.
Trying to be.
Do you see a wide variety of people? It suddenly becomes much more of a melting pot, isn't it?
You need to go a bit further west, really. I mean, you do have some of the Muslims and the Tibetans in Shanghai and Hefei and some of those other cities, but it's actually really only from Xi'an, where the terracotta soldiers are, and then Lanzhou, about halfway across, when you really start to see the ethnic mix.
Xi'an used to be the capital
of
China,
ancient
China. You went to Nanjing, or Nanking, as some people might call it. Most people will remember that as the place where atrocities were committed by the Japanese in 1937, and there was a memorial for the victims there. It had one time been the capital of the Ming Dynasty. What is the city like today?
Oh, it's an amazing city. I mean, it's near the coast, so it's booming economically. You know, you can buy pretty much everything you want there. It's a classic kind of Chinese city. But the problem is that the cities like Nanjing, I mean, they're real. It's not some Potemkin, you know, thing that's put on for show. They really are booming. There's a new middle class emerging. But the difference is that you only have to drive 10 miles outside Nanjing, and I do, and it's in the book, and there's a guy with a wooden plow being pulled by an ox who could have stepped out of the 15th century.
Are they still talking about what happened in 1937?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the interesting things about modern China, is that the Chinese government knows that it's unpopular in many areas with a lot of people. And so in order to sort of channel the anger away from themselves, they actually encourage anti-Japanese thought and websites, and they even allowed anti-Japanese demonstrations in 2005, which were in danger of getting out of hand. And it was at that point that the Communist Party said, oh, goodness me, we need to just stop, you know, encouraging people to be so militantly anti-Japanese.
Among the most disturbing places you visited was Henan, home to some 30 AIDS villages.
That's right.
This is where they send people who have been, who they know are HIV positive?
No, in fact, the people there have grown up there and they live there already. But what happened was the local government set up some blood donation schemes there, and they were unhygienically done. So somehow HIV got into the population through the people giving their blood. They would actually inject the blood back into the farmers who were donating their blood once they'd taken the plasma out to sell to the pharmaceutical companies. And the tens of thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of farmers in that area have been infected with HIV.
Has anybody been held responsible for this?
Not really, no. And in fact, the man who was the Communist Party secretary of Henan has actually been promoted.
The government gives them $1.20 a month. One man told you that AIDS, that China was waiting for everyone who'd contracted AIDS to die.
In that area, basically, that is the situation, because the local government doesn't want to look bad. They were responsible. They ran this whole scheme, but they don't want to admit to it. And if these people, if we can just stop them talking to the press, and I snuck in there in the back of a covered van so I could talk to them. But if I'd been detained, I would have had, and the people I was talking to would have had to spend time in the police cells. And so they're desperately trying to not let word get out so that they don't look bad to the higher authorities.
What about religion? For a long time, religion was banned. Now it's Christianity is tolerated. There is a lot of tension with the Muslims in the West. But in New York, we're most aware of the Falun Gong because people accost us on the subway all the time to tell us about the atrocities being perpetrated on their fellow religionists. Why do you think China is so threatened by Falun Gong?
I think it's not so much what the Falun Gong believe, it's the ability of the Falun Gong to mobilize. And what happened in 1999 was that 10,000 of them staged a sit-in on the front doorstep of China's president in the center of Beijing. And he woke up in the morning and saw this, and he kind of freaked out and thought, wow, if these people are able to mobilize politically, then that could be a threat to my rule and, as he put it, to the stability of China. So they built China. Falun Gong, you know, one man's cult is another man's religion in Western thinking. But for the Chinese, they built up the sort of cultishness of the Falun Gong and stressed how evil it was. And that was their way of suppressing it. But their actual concern was less with the spiritual nature of the movement than to do with its ability to mobilize. And that's the same with Christianity. If people kind of stay in their churches and don't, it doesn't lead to any kind of political activism, then they are by and large tolerated, not completely. There's still many problems. But if they start to get active politically, then they're going to run into a brick wall.
Well, there are more Christians than there are Communist Party members in China.
That's right. Amazing figures, roughly 70 million.
And also now more males than females because of the one-child policy that led to people selecting the sex of their children. There's a shortage of young women, isn't there? And didn't you learn that some Chinese men were importing or even kidnapping wives from North Korea and Burma?
That's right, from all around. And this is part of the sort of fallout, the blowback, if you like, of some of these Chinese policies. In the early 80s, they said you can only have one child to limit the population. A lot of female fetuses were aborted. And now that generation is of marrying age. And this was very noticeable on the road as I traveled through. You stop in villages and none of the men can find a wife. It's very, and that, you know, that has social implications, obviously, because that's very important in Chinese culture. You have to have heirs and sons, and so now if you can't find a wife, that leads to all sorts of disruptions within the Chinese social fabric.
Your final destination was the Muslim Northwest of China, and you discovered that it has become a fashionable destination for Chinese yuppies. Why?
It's kind of like in the U.S., you know, wealthy people traveling west for a vacation to Colorado, you know, 100 years ago, or like the discovery of the Celtic fringes in Britain in 150 years ago. It's kind of, it shows that you've got money to travel and you can travel in style, and also you've heard about these kind of wilder parts of your country, and you can boast to your neighbors that you drove your SUV, you know, all the way to the Northwest. So it's all just part of that emergence and the sort of new self-discovery among Chinese middle-class people.
Well, that's all positive, but you've said that the West needs to pay more attention to China's problems, and they are environmental. SUVs don't help, but it's the price of industrialization. There's bad air quality. There's a severe water shortage in some parts of the country. It sounds like there is a recipe for disaster brewing there.
This is what I'm worried about. And I think, as I mentioned, the fault lines that are emerging, I think there is a recipe for environmental disaster.
Well, what can the West do for a country that is now the fourth largest economy in the world? Shouldn't they be helping other people?
Shouldn't the West be helping
the Chinese?
Oh, the Chinese.
Because, you know, fourth largest is a pretty big economy.
Sure, except that they still, despite having that a large economy, the per capita is still, per person, is still very, very low. So they're trying to raise the living standard of the people on the bottom rung. How do they do that? Through economic progress. How do they do that? Through factories. And one other crucial thing is that they, and this makes me very pessimistic about the environment, is that they have to keep the economy growing because they don't have any ideological legitimacy. The only legitimacy that the Communist Party has is economic. So if the economy tanks, they're in real problems, because the only reason people are putting up with them is and their corruption is because people's lives are getting a little bit better. So they simply can't close down those polluting factories because they need to generate the jobs to absorb these people coming into the cities.
Need to keep the costs down so that they will have this kind of this huge volume of business, which has now backfired in other ways because people have been doing all sorts of things to cut costs, which include which have led to a number of scandals.
Absolutely. I mean, that this whole pet food thing, the toothpaste that's been infected with all sorts of chemicals, it's the real tip of the iceberg.
And seafood now is changing.
Seafood, that's right. I mean, it's the real tip of the iceberg because, you know, there's no checks and balances in China. And the Chinese think the way to deal with this is to, hey, get hold of the head of the food quality thing and execute him. And everyone in the West is going, no, just implement some kind of checks and balances so that it doesn't happen. And that's very any kind of checks and balances are difficult to implement in a one-party state.
You're a fluid Mandarin speaker living in London these days. Are you going to go back to China and not lose your command of the language?
I hope so. I think once you get into China, it kind of gets into your bloodstream. And even though perhaps I'm a little bit rusty on the Mandarin front, I hope I'll go back because it continues to be the biggest and most interesting story on the planet.
Rob Gifford's book, China Road, Journey into the Future of a Rising Power, is published by Random House. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.